Welcome to the Repossible Podcast. I'm your host, Bradley Charbonneau, and today we're talking with Benjamin Hardy. And we're about to get on the phone with him, but it was just one of those conversations where I felt like we could have talked for another 3 hours. We just had so much in common, so much to talk about. And what I really liked is that he sees, I think we see things in different ways. We're talking about sort of the same subjects. It's just he really pulls it up into a different way. And it's clear he's done his homework and done his studies on the topics because he can eloquently elaborate and enunciate on all we talk about. So here is Benjamin Hardy and me, Bradley Charbonneau, talking about everything, including his upcoming book, Personality Isn't Permanent. Enjoy. Okay, this is Bradley Charbonneau with the Repossible Podcast, and I have Dr. Benjamin Hardy on the phone, the author of the upcoming Personality Isn't Permanent. And we have been on the phone for seconds, and I think we both felt a mutual urge to turn on the record button because I think we're going to have so much to talk about. And I think, I mean, just having done my homework a little bit on you, Ben, and seeing our parallel lives, I think, I'm going to have to set the timer for this one because we're going to want to slow it down or turn it off because I think we're going to have a lot to say. So welcome, Ben. Great to have you.
Amazing to be here. Thank you for having me. Really interested to see where this conversation goes.
So I just, you know, I have all kinds of questions because I've been reading your work and you said one thing that it just hit home so deeply. And you said, you have a question. How much time are you spending consuming? How much time are you spending creating?
And it's a crazy question.
It is. But in my world, I think that divides the planet. So where were you heading
with
that?
I think that obviously we live in a consumer society. And we all consume, you know, I eat food every day. I consume information. I consume experiences, but I think that the problem, well, particularly for someone who wants to create a specific type of life, someone who wants to create, for example, a specific type of future. If you want to just get a job and if you just want to conform to some identity that generally pop culture has given you, then you don't necessarily need to be that creative. But if you want to get really specific and intentional about a type of person you want to become and a specific style of life and or adventure you want your life to be, or just living out a specific way of living, then you have to really start actually creating things. You've got to get into a creator mindset, not only a creator mindset about your future, but then you got to start creating stuff. I now have assets. I've got hundreds of blog posts. I've got books. Like these are things, these are creations, you know, that I easily could have just gone these last 4 or 5 years without creating. I think a lot of people, they look back and they didn't really create that much. And I think for me, so much success and freedom has come by just creating stuff and getting better at creating stuff.
Wow. See, so we could just stop right there because for me, that answers so much. I think that, and you also talk, and I'd love for you to talk more about the gain and the gap. So I think it's related, and the truck stuck in the snow.
Holy cow. There's so many good stories here. These are all different ideas. I'll start with the gain and the gap. This is actually, I have to admit, something I learned from Dan Sullivan. Something I blended and kind of tweaked and realized to make my own. And it's essential. It's essential. So the gain and the gap is the idea that most people, when they are pursuing goals, it's difficult for them to not get out of the gap between where they are and where their ideal is. And so like it from that mindset, and you know, James Clear, as an example, he talks about this in his book, Atomic Habits. And from his perspective, it's the reason people shouldn't set goals, which is actually bad advice. I think that James says a lot of good things, but I think in this sense, he gives incredibly bad advice. He says basically you should ignore goals altogether because goals make you unhappy. And from Dan Sullivan's perspective, that's because James and many people live in the gap. They can't get themselves out. You know, so what James said basically is, you know, goals are negative because if you don't hit it, you feel like a loser. And if you do hit it, then you realize that it didn't make you happy.
Right.
And I think that that's wrong. I think that first off, goals are essential. You can't have goals. And also you can't engage in what's called deliberate practice without specific goals. So in other words, right. You can't become an expert at something without a future self in mind. That you can't engage intentionally or deliberately in anything without a goal. You need goals, but the gain is really beautiful, because basically what you would do is, you know, obviously you have a future in mind. But what you're often measuring yourself against is not your future, but you're measuring yourself against where you formerly were. And so look at yourself, who, you know, 5 years ago. What, think about the gains over the last 5 years in your life. Yeah, there's probably been some shortcomings. Yeah, there's been some things that maybe haven't gone your way. But what have been the gains in your either your success and your relationships? And if you start thinking about that, if you start actually training your brain to see gains, then you start to notice that a lot more things can and have been happening than maybe you thought before. And you can train yourself to start looking at the gains on a daily basis. What were the good things that happened today? And when you start thinking that way, not only do you start to develop more confidence and you start to actually accomplish more, interestingly, you start feeling a lot better about your life. You start seeing movement. You start remembering more because you're paying attention to the good things, which makes you just feel better, and it gives you a sense of confidence to move forward. So I find that measuring the gain is really beautiful, but it's all, one other component of this, and I'll give a little story. We recently took to people from our church with yard work. And that, actually my two sons love this stuff because they were using big tools and axes and chopping down trees. And like, these are two kids that we adopted from the country in South Carolina. Yeah. So like, they are country boys, you know, and like, you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country, you know, something like that. And like, that's not me. Like, I grew up in the city, you know, I'm like, our kids like want to like go out and like dig stuff. And like, I don't want to do that. But they did this all day. And they loved it. They had so much fun. But while I was driving them home, I was just asking them, like, what were your favorite parts? And they started talking about it. But then they all of a sudden started to bring up, like, some aspects of what they didn't like. And I said, I stopped them for a second. I said, I hope you realize that if you go down this path and start think, you know, anything can build upon itself. So if you start thinking about one negative thing, you can, your brain will go to it. And I said, if you keep talking about the things you potentially didn't love, you're going to remember this experience in a negative way.
Yeah.
And so literally you have to design your memories. Like, you get to choose how you remember things. And you can, and from like a trauma perspective, you can go back and change former memories that were traumatic and realize all the gains that have come from them. And I actually think that that's essential to moving forward in your life.
And that's how we can, you talk about the past, you talk a lot about the past and the present and the future. And it sounds like that's a way to help not change your past, but to change your perspective on the past and get out the good parts. I mean, that's the gap in the gain, right?
It's a big part of it. And the, yeah. And the strange truth is you actually can change the past, but I'll explain why. So here's another story. So this is from my, my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law was recently at the gym exercising. And there was a very heavy woman at the gym. Yeah. Like, I'm talking extremely overweight. And the awkward part for most of the other people at the gym, and my mother-in-law could tell it was awkward because this is just something you don't see every day. She was wearing very tightly fitted gym clothing. And it was just, it was like, I'm talking very obese. Right. And it was just really awkward. Ends up, my mother-in-law ends up working out next to this woman, like on machines. And my mother-in-law is super social. So she struck up a conversation, and what she quickly found out was that this woman over the last probably 6 to 12 months has. And so my question for
you cut out there really quickly. The woman over the last 6 to 12 months, what happened?
She's lost 150 pounds.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So my question for you is this, like, so not everyone in the building knew that. My mother-in-law knew it because she asked her the question. Yeah. But my question for you is, if you found out about, you know, let's just say you were in this situation, how does that change your perspective of this woman? Does it change it at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you have your preconceived ideas and of where you think she came from and where you think she's going and where you think she is now.
It's crazy. I mean, basically from my mother-in-law's perspective, you go from potentially being a little critically judgmental to like going to being radically inspired and impressed. And like, she was so impressed that she began telling people at the gym, did you know that this woman's lost 150 pounds? Wow. So what this is the idea that you can't understand the content of anything without understanding the context. And so without proper context, this woman has lost 150 pounds. Without that context, you can't actually have a clear perspective, or you can, but it's not maybe the best perspective of who this woman is. You will misjudge the content if you don't have the right context. And the reason why you can change or flip or re-examine memories and even transform them is because you've got to realize your current view of the content is not fully accurate. I mean, that takes a high level of mental flexibility to realize that your current perspective is limited. Yeah. It's really an easy way to do that, though, is to realize, like, ask yourself again, who were you 10 years ago? Do you see the world the same way you did 10 years ago? Do you still have the same goals? Are you focused on the same things? Do you have all the same habits? Like, asking you, like, are you the same person you were 10 years ago?
Not even close.
So you see the world slightly. And so it's in what the researchers, and obviously in psychology and on identity now, found is that it's very smart to view not only your former self as a different person than your current self, but obviously your future self. Your future self is going to be different than you. They're going to see the world differently. They're going to have different goals. They're going to have different perspectives. And so if that's true, that your current views are not objective, nor are they actually accurate. You know, they could be to some degree accurate, but hopefully your future self sees the world better. There's a really good quote that, intelligence is the ability to make finer distinctions. Hopefully your future self can see things more clearly and make finer distinctions so that you can make better decisions. But if that's true, then your current view of the past is also probably inaccurate. You may not have the right context. You may not actually understand why things went the way they did. And if you don't have the right context, then you're actually misjudging the content of your past. And that if it's a traumatic experience, if it's a negative experience, if it's just how you view how things went.
Yeah.
Once you get more information or better information or shift your perspective, it's like what Wayne Dyer said, when you change the way you see things, the things you see change. And that's actually true.
Yeah. But then, so let's say we're at present day, and how do you change then, you know, your desired future self? How do you create that future self the way you'd like it to be?
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, obviously there's lots that goes into this. I like the idea of giving yourself space to think. I think journaling's good. Maybe having conversations with people is good, but the first key step is giving yourself permission to want what you want. Like, you know, they say that the number one regret on people's deathbeds is that they didn't have the courage to live the life they wanted, but they did what other people expected.
Yeah.
And so I think thinking to yourself, what would I actually choose if I wasn't worried about all the things that stopped me from moving forward in my life, whether that be my own fears that I could fail, my fixed mindset that I won't succeed, what would I actually just want if I could have it? What do I just genuinely want? Who would I want to be in the future? Like what would I want? What would I want my situation to be like? And not have all of the baggage that immediately stops you from thinking about it. I think just defining what you genuinely want and who you want to be and what your situation's like. And being flexible with that. I mean, again, as you grow maybe as you read better books or as you have new experiences, chances are you're going to envision maybe a slightly different future. But for now, what is it you would choose to have and what you would absolutely want if you weren't worried about what other people thought or if you weren't worried about failing or if et cetera. And just genuinely defining that out, like taking time to be intentional to like imagine it, you know, Albert Einstein said, imagination is more important than knowledge. Like one of the things that the Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert said is that the reason people don't imagine a future self is not because they can't, but because they don't. And he said, the reason is because it's a lot easier to remember the past than to imagine the future. And a lot of people just literally don't take the time to think about it. They don't take the time to like sit and think, what would I like my life to be like? What, and detail it. I know I'm sure you've done that to get where you've at. I've done that many times. I mean, I wouldn't be a professional writer. You know, I wouldn't be making the income or having the situation I have if I hadn't just taken the time to sketch it out imaginatively. But I think step two, which is just as crucial, but also just as avoided, is once you've actually clarified and defined your future self, which is crucial. It's crucial. And you would then need to start making that your new identity narrative, your new story. So what they say is that identity is based on the stories you tell. And often the stories you tell are based on your former experiences rather than your future experiences. Right. And so I think if you were to begin telling people, everyone, who you want to be and what you're going to do and what you're committed to, if you started to make that your new story, that like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to write a book, or I'm going to become a millionaire. I'm going to start a business, or I'm going to become an Olympian. Like, I don't really know what your story is or what your goal is. But if you started to make that the narrative of who you are and what you're about and what you're doing, and if you just started telling everyone, you'd get a little bit of negative feedback. Yeah, it might repel various people, but mostly it would create a lot of great accountability in your life, but it would also make you start to believe it more. And it would then lead you to beginning to act that way more. And so obviously then you've got to start acting it. But I think just thinking about what you really want and then telling everyone about it is probably the two biggest steps. Yeah. Obviously you then need to start making courageous steps in that direction. And actually like what you'd be saying, or what we were saying earlier, like start creating,
The creating part, I see it like a boat in the wake, or like a magnet. And once you start creating, like if I say, here, you right now, if I had said, hey, Ben, do you want to be on the podcast I don't yet have? You say, huh? Whereas I have a podcast, come on over. Oh, sure. Okay. And so because I created something, then I'm already building. I took action, and that action then it causes a reaction. But without that initial action, nothing happens. If it's just a thought that you never, you know, allow to materialize, then you're not getting very far.
Yeah. And there's beyond just narrating a new story, which is obviously really crucial because your identity is so big. That's why I think starting with the future self and starting with telling people about it is key, because identity really drives so much. And a lot of people haven't really conceptualized their own identity. It's really one of the reasons why personality tests are popular, is because personality tests give people an identity for them. And then they can just, think that that's who they really are, rather than having done the creative work and then, doing the framing work. The test kind of framed their identity for them, which ultimately becomes a fixed mindset. But one of the crucial aspects of upgrading your subconscious, which obviously your subconscious is 95% of your behavior, it's you on autopilot. Right. So your subconscious is basically your current self, and it's going to try to keep you at your current self because it's you on autopilot. It's you without thinking. It's your habits. It's your like assumptions. In order to actually upgrade the subconscious so that it elevates to the level of your future self, so that eventually the person you want to become becomes you on autopilot. And then you're going to have to recreate and continue to act intentionally rather than just on autopilot and default. Right. But there's a few things you need to do. One is obviously exposure. You need to expose yourself to better things, because right now your current views and even your current goals are based on what you're currently aware of. And so like a great story is Charlie Trotter. Like Charlie Trotter, the guy who was a famous chef in Chicago, he's dead now, but like Oprah loved his restaurant back in the 90s. Like it was one of the most like top restaurants in the world, like first fine dining experiences in the US. He would often bring impoverished kids into his restaurant, like homeless kids from the ghetto of Chicago. He'd bring groups of them into his restaurant and feed them a world-class, fine dining meal. And people would often criticize him, but what he was doing was he was totally shattering their view of what they thought reality was. And he would often get you know, emails or letters from these kids, like thanking him and, you know, so he was giving them new goals. And so I think one thing is to constantly expose yourself to better things. I call those subconscious enhancing experiences, but also then you want to have subconscious enhancing behaviors. And this is where you literally begin acting like your future self. Like you do. So if you're out of shape, but you want to be in shape, like you need to go and have an intense workout like that. There's an idea in psychology, it's called self-signaling. And it's basically the idea that your behavior signals back to you the type of person you think you are. So you judge yourself based on your actions. And so if you start doing things that your future self would do, sometimes that would take courage. Sometimes it's just creating something and failing, or just trying something or asking for something. Those, if you do those things more often, you know, you start to actually see yourself as that person. The third thing I would recommend is and I think this is a subconscious enhancing behavior, is literally investing money into your future identity. So like Zig Ziglar tells the story of a 400-pound man named Tom Hartman. And basically when Tom made the decision that he wanted to get in shape, he went to a suit store and he bought two fitted suits for a skinny person. And, you know, the person at the suit store, like the tailor, said, "Who are these suits for?" And this is a 400-pound man. Wow. And he was buying fitted suits for like a skinny person. And Tom Hartman said, "These are for myself." And I think the guy laughed at him. But like when you get to the point where your future self, you're no longer ashamed of it. And like you start doing things like that, where you start investing money into your future identity, like whether that be education, mentorships, clothing. Like, to be honest, that overweight woman, my mother-in-law was, my mother-in-law saw, she was wearing incredibly tightly fitted gym clothes. Like, right. Some people were disgusted by that, but from her perspective, she was trying to put herself in the mindset. Yeah. And so even though it may be embarrassing to others, you get to a point where you really stop caring what other people think.
You know, so I think I heard from your story, with your adoption process in foster kids, it was super tough. And you talked about how that was like the load in your truck and all your writing you did over all the years. And for me, it was my dad passing away in 2015. Ooh. And for me, that was the first domino to fall to then change just everything in my life. I mean, I had a design agency in San Francisco, my kids, my wife, my house, and I checked the business out the window, picked up my kids and wife, and we moved to Europe. And I closed down that business and I did what I always wanted to do, which is write. And I'm doing it. But for me, I look back and I see like my dad's passing as the trigger that finally the broke the camel's back. And so, and you, from what I hear or what I've read of you, a lot of this had to do with it was a really tough adoption process. In fact, it seemed, I mean, the way you told that story, I thought, wow, why are they making it so tough? I mean, maybe that's a different topic maybe, but it seemed just really traumatic. And so that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that seemed like your trauma that launched you on your new path. But my question is then, because I often hear this statement, something like, you know, don't wait for sickness or death or some, you know, catastrophic event in your life to change your life. And so for those people who don't want to wait around for that catastrophic event, and believe, it's not like I'm suggesting it to people. No, just wait for your dad to die of cancer. And then that's okay. Then you'll turn around your life and everything will be great. No. How can we do that without waiting for that huge life-changing event? Or do we need something that's going to finally, you know, loosen up the rusty chain and get this thing rolling? What do you think?
Well, I love the question. And, you know, what we're really talking about is that often people need extremely acute or painful experiences to finally learn from what life has been telling them for a really long time.
Right.
So sometimes it needs to become so painful that there's almost no other option but to change. As for us, you know, and just to give slight background on the story of the truck, there's a story of a truck, you know, and this is, I talk about this on a TED talk and I've written about it in articles, but basically a guy drives his truck up into the mountains to test it. This was like back in the 70s, I think, or something, but he was like, I think in Colorado or somewhere in the mountains, and it was really snowy and he just wanted to go up and test his brand new truck, his pickup truck. And anyways, he got stuck in some deep snow up in the mountains. and like literally was peeling out, couldn't get out. And this was like before cell phones. It's like he's up in the mountains, doesn't know what to do. And he has the idea to start chopping down some wood, which I think maybe was what he was going to do anyways, but he just starts chopping down wood and throwing the wood in the back of the truck. And, you know, ultimately, once the truck is full, he doesn't really know what else to do. He assumed that someone would drive by so that he could get help, but no one drove by. And so once the truck is filled, he gets back in his truck, you know, says a prayer, essentially turns on the gas. And because of the weight of the wood, the tires are able to actually get traction and he's able to back out. Whereas before it was just spinning out, but with the weight pushing down on the wood, on the tires were able to get traction. He was able to get out and move forward. And the idea is that's, you know, common concepts in the world are that you don't want a load. You don't want a load on you. You want to be completely free that you can move forward. And so you don't want to tie yourself down. You don't want a lot of responsibility. Whereas often in order to get the traction you need a load. And for me, that was our three foster kids. Like, we had a lot of freedom. I was in my first year of my PhD program, but it was not that strenuous. And we had a lot of time. And when you have a lot of time, you don't really use it very well. You know, it's that whole Parkinson's law idea. And so like once we had this load where like, and it was, it was mostly emotional, but it was also like practical. Like we had to like take these kids to school, put them to bed. Like all our free time, like we stopped going on dates. We stopped watching TV. Like all of a sudden, like we were dealing with these kids.
You went from zero kids to three kids. Boom. Just like that. Right.
Boom. Yeah. Three siblings. And these are not like, you know, these kids had a lot of emotional problems. Like they were neglected for a long time. And like, they were like throwing stuff at our house and like, you know, or like going through crazy emotional, like, yeah, it was wild. And you know, I wasn't, you know, admittedly, I didn't really love it at the beginning, but what it forced me to do is it forced some hard thinking on my part, you know, cause like you, I'd been wanting to write for a few years and yeah, it just gave me that traction. Like all of a sudden, because of what I was dealing with, I no longer, whatever excuses or reasons for not writing stopped weighing so much because I was already dealing with a much heavier weight. I was like, my perspective changed a lot. Yeah. And so whatever fears or reasons why I was no longer writing stopped really being good enough because I was now dealing with something much, much more painful or much more just intense where I was like, you know what, if I fail at blogging at this point, who cares? Like, I think maybe it was a trigger. It was a great trigger. And as far as to answer your question, as far as do you have to wait for that gap? Well, we didn't actually lead me. I mean, I didn't know it was going to lead me to becoming a successful writer, but, I knew it was going to change my life. There's a concept I talk about in Willpower Doesn't Work, which is forcing functions. Forcing functions are essentially putting that trigger in place to force you forward. So as an example, I'll give a few examples to kind of make this idea make sense. But a forcing function is basically something you've put in place that forces you forward. So let's just say you've been wanting to go on a trip, you know, buying the plane ticket would be a forcing function. Like you just literally take that action. Yeah. Maybe you don't, you know, you might maybe have to throw it on your credit card. But if you buy the plane ticket, you're probably going to go on the trip. And if you don't do that, then who knows how long it's going to take. And so it's literally doing an action that forces the next action. One of the things, like, so Dan Martell, he's an entrepreneur. One of the things he does when he really needs to get a lot done is he goes to like a library and he leaves his power cable home. So he knows his computer's got like 2 hours worth of juice and like, that's good. He knows he's got to focus because in 2 hours his computer is going to be dead, you know? So it's like he creates a forcing function. Like he also, and I've done this as well, like he ends his work day short. Like he tells his wife he's going to pick up the kids from school. I've done that for years. Like my work day ends at 3 p.m. Because once school's over, I pick them up. Like that's, you know, and like that's a forcing function.
Yeah. And guess how much more efficient you are until 3 p.m.
Yeah. I mean, if I ended my workday at noon, I'd have to get a lot more done in the morning, you know? So it's just putting obstacles or putting situations in place that lead you to, you know, your own best intentions without such constraints are never enough, you know? And so, you need to put situations in place. Like the the Will Durant, the famous historian, said the ability of the average person could be doubled if the situation demanded it.
Wow. Yeah. But that's the thing, if the situation demanded it, and that's
so when, you got to create that situation.
Yeah. 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 I have a chapter called something like The Conundrum of Comfortable, and how if things are comfortable, then you're not necessarily pressed hard enough to maybe do the thing you want to do. And that's, I suffered is a big word. I suffered from that for a decade because I'm fine. Oh, you know, I'd really like to do that, but no, I'm okay as it is. Meanwhile, simmering deep inside of me is this desire to do something I wasn't doing. And I wasn't doing it because they're okay. They're, you know what? It's okay. You can convince yourself either way. You know, what was the saying? Something like whether or not you believe you can do it, or whether you can believe you can do it, or you can't, or you don't believe you can do it. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, what I like about what you're saying is that you can proactively create situations that eliminate the comfort. And I'll explain. I'm actually in one right now. So at the recording of this podcast, I'm in the middle of writing a book that I have 2.5 more weeks to write. The deadline is literally in 2.5 weeks. And I already had a short timeline on this book as it was. It's a co-authorship. And there's a lot of collaborative elements of this. I'm the writer, although I've got a great editor. Tucker Max is helping me with writing this book, who's a smart writer. But so this book's called Who Not How. It's with Dan Sullivan. Let's just say the short timeline on this book, but also the social pressure of the fact that it's not just my book. There's another author. I already know that in the next 2.5 weeks, and even in the last month, I've produced stuff that I would never have produced had this timeline not existed. And in the next 2 weeks, I have to finish this book. Like, from my perspective, I have no option. Obviously, I could just throw in the towel, but that would destroy a lot of like the things that I've been wanting to create for a long time anyways. And so the pressure that you create is pressure that you create, and you have the option to always eliminate it. But if you want to get yourself moving forward, you create those situations where you have to rise up and you have to, you know, and in order to do that, sometimes you need, because you will hit many of your own glass ceilings. The best thing you can do, first off, is understand emotional intelligence and psychological flexibility. Psychological flexibility is the idea that you hold your own identity and your own emotions loosely as you're moving towards a goal. So like, you're going to have negative emotions, obviously, and you're going to have limiting beliefs based on your current identity. You have to hold those loosely, and you need to record them when they come up. Like, journaling about your emotions is so key when you're dealing with something negative or when you're pursuing something that's difficult. But also fast and open communication. Like, so if you're in a partnership, it could be in your marriage, it could be like in my case, working on this book, I found that my biggest problems were created when I would not open up fast about the fact that I was stuck. And I let a week go by where I tried to do it by myself rather than communicate, in this case, to Tucker and say, dude, I'm stuck. And that would then create problems for everyone because a week was wasted where I was just bottling it. And there's a really good quote from Alcoholics Anonymous that you're as sick as your secrets. And so, yeah, I mean, if you're struggling with something,
I was deathly ill for a while then.
You probably were, we all were, you know, that's the nature of trauma or of, you know, yeah. I mean, really it's we call it a frozen personality, but you know, it's, you get stuck and you're isolated and you're not opening and you're not sharing. So I think fast communication, when you're putting yourself in these high stakes, high pressure situations, the courage or the confidence and the emotional regulation abilities to just get them out, talk about it, get fast feedback, get a quick shift in perspective. If you're not openly communicating about what you're dealing with, then you're probably bottling it and you're not making fast enough progress and you're going to put yourself in a negative situation. So like, pressure will be bad if it destroys you, you know, but it will be really good if you can emotionally evolve through it and become a better person.
Wow, as sick as your secrets. That one hurts.
You're as sick as your secrets. Yeah. I mean, that's the beast of, that's the beast of trauma. It's the beast of isolating yourself. And it's really what makes, you know, what Gabor Mate, the brilliant, you know, doctor says, is that, you know, and this is not just said by him, but your personality is often the coping mechanism of your former problems that you haven't dealt with. And so usually with trauma, what happens is something negative happens to you and you don't clear it. You know, you bottle it, and then you don't talk about it, or you don't openly admit what's going on, and then you become as sick as your secrets. And so then you start coping in negative ways to avoid the problem, usually in the forms of addiction or other forms of escapism or, you know, distraction. And at some point you just have to face the truth, and then you can finally, once you face it, you can transform it. And just like we were talking about before, you can get better context, you can change the narrative, you can change your emotional reaction to it. But until you open up about it, first off to yourself, but then to others, your personality in your life is going to be a coping mechanism for avoiding your secrets or your problems.
But then I used to call it coming out of the closet, or coming out of the writer's closet in my case. And once I finally did that, I finally allowed myself to accept it, then it just changed everything. And then it wasn't as hard, but this next step was to publicly admit it. It's so funny, you know, how we are.
Well, that's exactly what we're talking about at the beginning, that your new narrative needs to be what you're going to do and what you want to do, and being more honest with yourself and others about what it is you're going to do, rather than hiding your true desires so that you can fit in with the crowd, or so that you're not rejected, or so that you don't look stupid.
Yeah. And it's so funny the weight we put on others that we think they're putting on us, but they're really not. You know, when you say, I'm going to be a writer, they say, great. You think, I've been traumatized by this for 10 years. And all you say, great, like it's nothing. And they say, it is nothing. You're going to do it. Good for you.
You know, yeah. They don't care. Like, seriously, whatever it is you want to do, tell everyone about it. Like, I think it becomes a lot, your life, your identity, first off, becomes a lot more clear when you just own what you really want. And once you begin telling people about it, it really clarifies your identity, which also really opens up your motivation. Motivation is contingent upon being clear about a goal and then a pathway to getting there, and then building the confidence to get it. But you build the confidence first off by owning it, admitting it, and then obviously working towards it and beginning to do it. But if you're not telling people about it, and if you're not just open and honest about what you would love to do, and if you haven't clarified it, then you're not going to be intentional, but also you're going to have identity confusion, which is going to lead to confused behavior, depression, frustration, a lack of transformational learning experiences, a lack of progress, and you know, then a bad past, which you frame in a negative way versus a past that's working for you. So it's essential that you just begin to crystallize and clarify and define for yourself who you want to be, and then begin telling everyone about it, and then begin working towards it. You know, even if you've got to work towards it at 5 a.m. for the first couple of years, or 10 p.m, you know, but like whatever you do, start acting as that person as much as possible. And then you'll become that person.
You know what is I really like about your title, The Personality Isn't Permanent, is that I thought for quite a while that, okay, I want to be this different person. I want to be this writer. And I used to think it was such a big mountain, and I have to climb the mountain and then succeed, and that will be the rest of my life. Whereas what I really enjoy about your permanence, or actually lack of permanence in your title, is that I could be this writer person for a decade or something, or 7 years, or 17 years, or sure, it's the rest of my life. But I like what I'm getting out of your title is that it doesn't have to necessarily be that. And so in that case, it doesn't have to be as monstrous of a mountain as you may think, which is why you're holding back and not even taking a step towards it, because you think it's so big and scary.
Yeah. I mean, the truth is your future self is going to see the world differently than you do now, especially if you're working towards something specific. Because if you're working towards something specific and you're making courageous and intentional steps forward, you're going to have a lot of what are called peak experiences, which leads to you seeing yourself more flexibly. So what I like about what you're saying, and it's true, is that you hold to your own ideas. You can commit to decisions better with more confidence. you don't have to put the weight of the world on your shoulders. You can be a lot more flexible even in how you see your current self, because you know in the future when you go through changes and new experiences, you're going to actually probably be able to set better goals or different goals, or your priorities are going to shift. I mean, in having three foster kids, now having five kids, years ago. I mean, even though I'm still a writer, I don't value certain things the way I used to. And I don't prioritize things the way I used to. And I think I'm a lot more mature than I used to be. But by that same token, I know I sure hope that I continue to have such experiences and learnings that the future me is a lot more mature than the current me and sees things a little better. And so I think from that perspective, even your goals are impermanent, and even your perspectives, your paradigms, if you're growing and learning, which I hope you are, those things are hopefully becoming better.
Yeah. But once you can, if you can get over that first mountain, then it's just, you know, the mountains beyond, even if they're bigger, they're just easier because that first one.
Oh, hugely.
Yeah. I have a
program. Did you have confidence at that point?
Yeah, exactly. I have a program I run called Spark, where I bring together parents and kids, and the parents and kids write a short book together. And we do it within a month, because I, like you say, I'm big on deadlines. And if we're going to get it done in a month, we're going to get it done in a month. But I sometimes will sort of whisper to them, I said, what I'm secretly interested in is your second book, because I want this first book to get done and out of the way, because you're going to see it as this huge mountain. Let's just get that one done. And then you'll feel that freedom of surpassing that first mountain, and then we'll get to the good stuff. Because then you'll be in flow, then you'll be free, you'll be light, and well, light with a load, I get you on your truck. But getting beyond that first mountain is such a freedom that that's one of my main goals in getting this short book done with kids. And it gives the kids the confidence as well. Then I have a video of this 8-year-old girl. She's opening her paperback books that she just got in the mail. And it's just a delight to see her face. And she's like, my books, they're here. And do you think, I mean, the girl's 8. Do you think, how many more books is she going to write in her life? She's 8 years old and she already has a book with her name on it. It's just, it's just a delight. So getting over that first one, though, that's what I'm kind of secretly trying to do. Just getting them, let's get over this hurdle that you think is huge, but I'm going to help show you that it's not, and I'm going to help you get there. Okay? They're like, okay. Let me do it.
I mean, I agree. What's interesting for me in your experience, so I believe, for example, so Willpower Doesn't Work was my first traditionally published book. I wrote a few ebooks before that. But Willpower Doesn't Work. So what I like about what you're saying is that if I hadn't written that book, I wouldn't have been able to write the next book. And the next book, in my opinion, is 10 times better, even though interestingly, it was actually 10 times harder. And it took 2 or 3 times longer. But the epigraph of Personality Isn't Permanent is a quote. And it's basically, this quote is, a painting is never finished. It simply ends in interesting places. And basically, if I had never finished Willpower Doesn't Work, I'd still be working on it. And it would be a very different book than the one that I published 2.5 years ago. It may be a better book, or maybe it would be a more muddled and confused book at this point. But at some point, thankfully, the publisher just said, you have to be done. And so I stopped working on it, and it ended in an interesting place, even though it will never be finished. But because I did that first book, it gave me, some confidence, but like when I look back on when I even go back to read it, I'm with that book. Personality, and in other words, I don't think I would have been able to write this second book, which is so much better, so much deeper, had I not gotten that first one out of my system. Yeah, some people, their first book is freaking amazing, right, but that often then limits their future books. Whereas if you are willing to get some other, I wouldn't call it crappy work, but just get your best work, but get it out of your system and get it out there fast. Yeah. Put a lot of incomplete paintings out there, because none of them are going to ever be finished. Even Personality Isn't Permanent. Like, I still want to send like edits to my editor, but she's like literally cut me off at this point. Like, it's done. Like, I'm like, okay, I guess it's finished in this interesting place, but
blocked your number.
Like, yeah, yeah. She's like, dude, let's talk when the next book is in prep. But like this book, you're done.
You're done.
But it's one thing that's really good is to look back on your former work. You can appreciate it with new eyes, which is just like memory. It's like looking at the past. You appreciate old experiences with new eyes. You also realize also how far you've come. You know, when I read a lot of my blog posts, a lot of them which have been read by even millions of people, like I'm almost ashamed of them when I look at them now from my current perspective. Not that, but you can value what it was because you can read it within context, which I think is really key, is seeing things in context. Like in the context in which it was created, you can really respect it. But now my current context, I'm like, oof, I would never write that. Right. But that's, again, going back to the gain. So you can, when you go back, when you've got a lot of creative work behind you, especially if you're going through the deliberate practice stuff where you're actually getting better because you have a clear vision of yourself, the essential difference between deliberate practice and just practice is people who are in the gym just doing the same workout routine without a goal are actually not getting any better. In fact, over a long enough period of time, they're atrophying and getting worse. It's
right.
And so in order to actually create something unique and special and focus, which you couldn't, like in your physique, in your fitness, in your skills, in order to engage in the type of training or practice that leads to specific, researchers say you have to have a future self in mind that has the capabilities you currently want. Or the situation or the, you know, and so what's fun is when you actually go through that and you do it for a few years and you create something that really just broke you. And then you look back on your former work and you're ashamed by it, you know, like not really ashamed in a bad way, but there's a quote from Alain de Botton, the British philosopher. And he said, if you're not embarrassed by who you were 12 months ago, you didn't learn enough. And I just think it's fun to look back at former work and be like, wow, you know, like, you know, I would never do that again.
Yeah. Then I think I'm going to bring this to a close with how we started, because I asked how much time are you said, how much time are you spending consuming? How much time are you spending creating? And here we go, coming back full circle, because you just said, let's look back at the work you created. But if you're just consuming, and by consuming, I sort of mean media, or I'm watching TV.
Yeah, I mean, it could be anything. Social media, it could be anything. It's essentially apathy.
Yeah, it's not necessarily bad. Just, you know, watching Netflix and, I mean, reading books I consider consuming as well. But I think you need to let it out. It's sort of like the exhaust vent, and otherwise you're going to explode, or your secrets are going to make you sick.
And you need other really important aspect of all this, that if you're not creating, then you're consuming mindlessly. But once you start creating something, then your consumption has a purpose. And it actually, like, for example, if I'm writing a book, I'm going to consume a lot, but that's right. Going to be purposeful learning. I'm going to read the types of books that I want to learn about that will translate to me writing the book. And so if you're not purposeful about creating something, then your consumption is not leading to anything.
Wow. Thanks. You just helped, because one of my books in my series is called Create, and you just helped with the, purposeful creating. That's really good. Because as I said, I don't care if your first book is terrible, I just want you to get it out of your system. It's sort of like you're blocking the drain almost, and the drain is clogged and you need to let it go or it's going to be clogged forever. But I hear you when you say you're purposefully creating, because then, as you said, because then consuming is okay, because now it's research.
And it's building towards the purpose, you know? Yeah, and you start to see it everywhere. Like when your brain's really working on a project,
yeah,
you know, in psychology, we call it selective attention, you know, but you're literally setting your brain up to actually find what you're looking for rather than just mindlessly not finding anything. You know, your brain gets lazy if you don't have goals.
And you know, what's so fun about that. And I hope as an author, I'm sure you get this, but you're working on a project and everything seems relevant. It's just,
because your brain is now looking for it because you're freaking absorbed in a creative project.
Exactly. But that's the dream I wish on so many people. I said, oh, you just got to work out. You're clearly not working on a project deeply enough, because this would be relevant for so many reasons.
Yeah, no, it's a good and a bad place to be. It's a bad place to be because you literally become so uninteresting to everyone around you. Because like you can't not think about it, you know? And so you've got to like work hard to just be present to like other ideas, or just like watching a movie that you don't care about. Like, You know, like it becomes very consuming.
Okay, you know? You totally are calling me out because I'll be in a conversation and I'm about to say something and they say, I know, Bradley, this is relevant to your upcoming book. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, you know, you got to get used, you got to develop an ability to go on and off, which can be so hard when you're that deep in a project because everything seems like it's connecting.
Yeah, yeah. But I got to say, the upsides are bigger than the downsides. It's still more
fun. Yeah. Oh, huge.
Well, on that note, I'm going to wish everybody a creative and creating day. And by the way, I see those as two very different. I don't see creative necessarily the same as create. For me, create is sort of making, doing, creating. You know, it's almost not necessarily art, but I don't know if you know Joanna Penn, but Joanna Penn says, "Have you made art today?" And I really like
that. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the day goes a lot better if you've even spent 30 minutes doing some form of creative work.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, I kind of quietly think that's one of the secrets to peace on the planet.
I think it's a big aspect of mental health for sure. Yeah. I think if your brain is actively working on something, it's probably not going to atrophy, you know, to the level. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
You know, I think if your brain's working, it's working, you know, it's connecting dots. It's not just getting lazy.
You know, and I think like people who complain or people who are causing trouble in the world, I think, don't you have a project? You should be working on a book and you wouldn't be, you know, causing trouble.
Yep, totally.
That is my biased artist writer perspective, I suppose. But I'm sticking with it.
Well, it was an amazing conversation, man. Really appreciate you letting me be on your show and for the fun way that this conversation went.
Yes, thank you very much for being here. I'm really excited about your book and your upcoming book. And thank you so much for taking the time. It's been a pleasure and look forward to talking with you again soon.
All right, brother. Have a good one.